I wanted to welcome everybody to the afternoon session on cybersecurity. I'm David Abrams. I typically describe myself as an engineer with a law degree. I spent many years designing hardware and software before I went to law school, which, by the way, is tremendous fun, particularly if you don't want to be a lawyer, and I recommend it to everyone. Cybersecurity is a tough topic because it's incredibly broad. I mean, it covers everything from trying to talk my dad into putting anti-malware on his computer, which I failed miserably, to protecting the national infrastructure from espionage and cyber attacks. It encompasses, a lone hacker, cracker trying to break into or find vulnerabilities in operating system, hacktivists who either deface websites or start DDoS attacks to push a political point, criminal organizations that are purely looking for economic advantage, and then state-sponsored espionage and potential harm that we've seen recently in Stuxnet and Flash. So luckily, we have a panel with a wide variety of experience in different areas of cybersecurity. I'm going to let each panelist introduce themselves and talk about the aspects of cybersecurity that they're interested in. And then I'll probably ask a few questions, and then I'll open the floor to questions.
Great. Hi, my name is Kyle Courtney. I am an attorney currently working at Harvard Law School as the head of external research and resource sharing. Also, I'm invited here for the past 6 years. I've been teaching a cyber law course to information assurance master's and PhD students. That is kind of a hybrid degree between law and computer science and is very much fun to teach. I talk a lot about research, I talk a lot about cyber breaches, I talk a lot about cybersecurity, a lot of things we'll talk about in the panel, but today I'm going to be talking about vulnerability, especially when it comes to data breaches. Now, everybody talks about this in a way that makes it kind of a fun topic because, as we know, the pattern is world's biggest breaches. Another year goes by. Every single year, it's like, oh, now we have the next biggest data breach. To me, it seems to be that the consumers and businesses are kind of just viewing this as the cost of business. This is what happens, regardless of the outcome of the breach. A lot of times, people will, even when they get their notices in the mail, will ignore this. I mean, everybody in this room has probably received an email or a notice saying, hey, something you subscribe to, either whether it's Blockbuster or Entertainment, that's the one I recently got in the mail, which I forgot I had a subscription to Blockbuster. I want to describe it to my students. I'm like, there used to be something called a video store, and you would go to it. And anyway, so whether it's Blockbuster or your bank or anything like that, there was a great study that came out that said 39% of people that received these privacy or database breach notices thought it was junk mail and threw it out. So we're talking about a shift here. It's much like Justin Harlan described a shift in how society views privacy in like a two-part test. And I'm not here to talk about that. I'm talking about the similar legal evolution in the way and the nature that consumers and businesses just absorb these data breaches as this is the common, this is the price of business. I mean, this week alone, we have LinkedIn lost 6.5 million usernames and passwords, which got dumped on the open market. We had eHarmony and Last.fm also have breaches. That just happened this week. So this is a very, very common occurrence. As we can see here, though, the data breach results are bad. They're bad for business, they're bad for consumers. You have injury from loss of security, including a higher risk of identity theft, potential invasion of privacy. We have claims for emotional distress, credit monitoring costs, decline in your credit rating potentially by setting up these monitoring services. And businesses themselves have operational losses and costs, which I think are astronomical. I know I say it's the price of business, but tell that, I think it was Epsilon that had a breach that's gonna cost something like $2 to $4 billion to fix over time. It's the world's, they didn't breach the most records, but they're spending the most to fix it. It's unbelievable operational loss. In addition to that, you get regulatory scrutiny. Most businesses don't like regulatory scrutiny that I'm aware of. Reputation, brand damage, stock prices. You have to answer to a board, or your shareholders may be upset if you didn't employ encryption necessary to do this. This may drop the value of your stock. So it's some things to consider. Now, when these breaches occur, what is the outcome? Well, sometimes it's litigation. Sometimes it's settlement, sometimes it's litigation. This is taken from an empirical study of a last decade of breaches, and it's a paper that I can link to later. basically it's showing the 20 most common causes of action when you have a data breach. And obviously these are a mix of state and federal claims. And as we can see, the top few are a mix of both state and federal here. But the number one theories of liability against these companies usually fall in the realm of negligence, which I'm going to talk about a little bit today. Breach of contract, there's state and federal statutory claims, so maybe there's a Consumer Protection Act available in the state that you can sue under. Maybe there's various privacy violations on the state or federal level. And then there's the newer ones, which is negligent intentional or infliction of emotional distress, meaning you are so harmed possibly by this. It's kind of the same fear you have if somebody burglarizes your house. And they, you know, people may go and seek help for the fear of being re-burglarized. A lot of people are introducing these. It's a very high bar to pass, though, but I have seen it in various cases. So let's talk about negligence for just a moment. Negligence is a four-part test. It derives from common law. It's usually found in most state law. It is found on the federal level as well. It does not necessarily compensate you for nuisances in life. So you have to have some actual harm. Well, that's the problem. So there may be a duty, a breach of that duty, and causation of the harm due to that breach, but a lot of courts are finding that the risk of identity theft, or the fact that you have to hire credit monitoring services or anything as a result of a breach, do not necessarily rise to the occasion necessary to find that last factor. When plaintiff steps into the courtroom, he has to prove all four of these. Now, there's trouble proving 1, 2, and 3 sometimes, but a lot of times in the courts, there's trouble proving number 4, and we're gonna go into that specifically. But first, let's go back in time, just for a moment. It's 1932. There's a tugboat coming up from Virginia, towing coal. This is the case called the T.J. Hooper case, which was written by Justice Learninghand, or Judge Learninghand at the time, at the Circuit Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Now, how is this relating to technology today? Well, what was going on at the time was there was these tugboats cruising on the East Coast. A radio display, which was basically the weather channel of the day, broadcast something out of Maryland and out of Delaware saying, hey, there's a gale coming, there's a storm coming, you better watch yourself. Now, most of the tugboats that had radio receiver sets went into the Delaware River and rode out the storm. The T.J. Hooper, along with a couple others, did not have those radio receiver sets on their boat at the time period. Now, it wasn't a common custom or an industry standard at the time for boats to have these radio receivers. Absolutely not at all. In fact, most people brought them with them, merchant marines or seamen or the captains, had their own private one at home and brought it with them when they were going out to sea. But the problem is that just because it wasn't an industry standard doesn't mean that you shouldn't be held liable for this. Learninghand said, a whole calling may have unduly lagged in the adoption of new and available devices. And more importantly, he emphasized that this was cheap. This was a cheap device that anybody could have. He equated it as much as the captain used binoculars, that is the eyes of the ship, while these radio receiver sets, which are cheap and portable, are the ears of the ship. And that there are precautions so imperative that even their universal disregard will not excuse their omission. So if we just have password authentication for our databases with the password as 12345, obviously we're not adopting the technology necessary. It doesn't matter if it's an industry standard or not. It's gonna be tough to convince somebody we need more security for our databases, for our information. And the board says, well, what happened last year that you want to increase your budget for security systems? And they say, nothing happened, but a lot happened to a lot of other people. And they go back to these and they say, look at all these harms, look at all this breach that's available. But the problem is if you don't adopt this cheap technology, well then it would appear that, okay, you're negligent. There was a duty, there was a breach of that duty. You required two-point authentication for your database, you do site key passwords, you do something along those lines. You drop WEP, you do some kind of other encryption standard. If you don't do that, you'll be held liable. You would think that would be the case. But unfortunately, that standard is not held out in the courts. 1932 is not similar today. And TJX admitted in 2007, someone, and we know who that someone is now, someone accessed one of their payment systems of about over 40 million credit cards, debit cards. They specifically stole the Track 2 information. So this Track 2 was stored on vulnerable wireless networks, which was against the payment card industry's data security standards, PCI DSS. And they basically said, well, you breached that code. You're allowing people to take all this wireless information. And you would think if you got this into a courtroom that obviously this would be a slam dunk. The analysis said you failed to adequately secure all this information. And by the way, Track 2 is the information, is the most important information. That's how you can make phony debit credit cards. That's how you do it, with this information. Well, they get this into court, and this is the actual site to the thing, and sure, there was a duty, there was a breach of that duty, there was a causation of harm due to that, but damages was difficult to prove. Banks sued. Banks sued TJX and other people and said, hey, we had to reissue 40 million new debit and credit cards as a result of your breach. That's a lot of money for our company to do that. But the problem was, is that there's something called the economic loss doctrine. Now, this is an old doctrine which says, hey, if you have something that you think is important, you should contract about it. The economic loss doctrine bars purely economic losses. It said it is unrecoverable in negligence actions. So economic damages alone are not proof. Courts want to give room to reduce this risk and allow you to contract. So they basically told any of the banks that sued to reissue these credit and debit cards that, hey, this is an economic loss, and you should have contracted with Visa or MasterCard to cover this type of fraud. So that's a lot of money out of the bank. What about the consumers, just real briefly? Consumer suits have equally failed. Courts have said that this increased risk of identity theft, any kind of paying for the creditor monitoring over the time, the series of decisions the last few years have basically stated you must show sufficient, appreciable, non-speculative present harm, and that inability to show real damages failed that negligence claim. So this is the holding. It doesn't matter if it's impairment of access to credit, worry and emotional distress, economic damages from pocket expenses. That's the end of it. However, there is one light at the end of the tunnel, and that was just decided last year in the First Circuit, where you have to wait, the consumer, the business, has to wait until the data is actually used illegally overseas or somewhere else. So no matter how much you want to sign up for that credit monitoring and get it paid back, no matter how much you want to sue these specific companies for negligence, you have to wait. You have to wait until fraudulent accounts are opened on your dime and then sue, because then you'll have actual damages. So that's my 10 minutes of interest area. I'm just gonna pass it on now.
Great. I'm John Savage. I'm on the faculty at Brown University. I'm a computer scientist. And I've spent most of my career doing theoretical computer science. But I spent a year in the State Department, 2009-10, as a Jefferson Science Fellow in the Cyber Affairs Office, which was about 3 months old at the time. And they were on the front line with respect to all international issues having to do with cybersecurity. So I had an opportunity through that experience to get to know many of the issues that we're talking about here today. I also sat on a White House committee that drafted a national strategy for trusted identities in cyberspace. And I travel with another bureau to Geneva as a subject matter expert for negotiations at the International Telecommunications Union. I teach a course at Brown entitled Cybersecurity and International Relations, which is a course designed for non-computer science majors, although I have about half my students are computer science students, the other half are typically poli-sci and international relations students. I've got some prepared remarks which I'm gonna read to you, and that will give you a picture of what opportunities I see here. So as you heard, if you were here this morning and this afternoon, that cyberspace is really replete with challenges, and many of them have a legal dimension. Cybercrime has exploded. Financial losses due to cybercrime are very difficult to estimate, but are certainly at least in tens of billions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars per year in the U.S. alone. The theft of intellectual property via the internet is staggering. Former U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense Lynn said in Foreign magazine Foreign Affairs, "While the threat of intellectual property loss is less dramatic than the threat to the critical national infrastructure, it may be the most significant threat that the United States will face over the long term. Sustained intellectual property losses could erode both the United States' military effectiveness and its competitiveness in the global economy." In addition to these problems, governance of the internet has become contentious. The U.S., which developed the internet technology, also created vehicles to manage it, namely the Internet Engineering Task Force, IETF, and the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICANN. The IETF set standards in conjunction with the World Wide Web Consortium and other organizations. The IETF has no formal membership requirements, and it makes all of its documents freely available. It arrives at decisions via consensus. The International Telecommunications Union, ITU, plays a role in setting telecommunications standards, which overlaps in some areas with the IETF. The IETF was created, I think, sometime in the 1980s, if I'm not mistaken. The ITU came into existence about 1848 to set standards for telegraph communication. The ITU is a specialized agency of the UN. Its voting members are states, and each state has one vote. At this time, some nations, notably the Russian Federation and China, want the ITU to manage the internet. These countries are more concerned with state security than privacy and freedom of expression, two issues which I'm sure you know are of paramount importance to the United States. The U.S. government released its international strategy for cyberspace in May of 2011. It's a good read, and among other things, it calls for multi-stakeholder management of the internet, a process that, like that, is run by the IETF. That is, any interested party can participate in its deliberations. These typically include representatives of industry, government, and private citizens such as academics. All nations are free to participate, but the nations cannot amongst themselves make decisions, okay? Unlike the ITU, where it's only the nations who vote. Cyber conflict is also an active topic of discussion in cybersecurity circles. I've been to many workshops where people have talked about cyber norms. I attended one this past weekend at the Battelle Memorial Institute, ran on to try to formulate a cyber doctrine, like a nuclear doctrine only for cyber. So as you know, many nations have created military units to defend and fight in cyberspace. The last time I looked, there were at least 20 nations that have done this. Hopefully we're not going to use these cyber weapons, but you may recall that Russia launched a denial of service attack on Georgia in 2008, just before it invaded the country. And the U.S. is reported to have had a big hand in designing and launching the Stuxnet worm that destroyed centrifuges in the Natanz refinement facility in Iran. So now the conflict is a realistic possibility. Discussions over cyber doctrine, as I mentioned, are also occurring. As part of this effort, various parties are trying to formulate acceptable norms of behavior in cyberspace. I think eventually treaties will be formulated concerning this new domain. As you can see, there are many opportunities exist for the legal profession to contribute to the cybersecurity agenda. The Convention on Cybercrime represented a landmark development. Its purpose is to harmonize national laws on cybercrime, improve national capabilities to investigate such crime, and increase international cooperation. It was adopted by the Council of Europe in 2001 and came into force in the U.S. in 2007. It's been ratified by about 40 nations. Key players, such as Russia and China, have not adopted the convention. Thus, it needs to be rethought and possibly replaced or supplemented. The theft of intellectual property represents a serious challenge to Western firms. While the Chinese government has formally committed itself to the protection of IP rights, in practice is not living up to its commitment. Thousands of agents based in China have engaged in attempts to steal IP from American companies, particularly those in the defense industrial base. China needs to better monitor and control its citizens in this area. In addition, China, as with other developing nations, has created domestic policies that require that IP and products sold by Western nations and firms in China be provided to the government. So China needs help in truly learning the value of protecting IP and methods of doing it effectively. This is an important challenge for the legal profession. Now, just so that you know that I'm not biased against the Chinese, I will tell you that. And if you go down to Pawtucket, Rhode Island, which is the town contiguous with Providence, you'll find the Slater Mill. Samuel Slater was considered a hero of the United States, the father of the Industrial Revolution. Why? Because he knew how to build a textile mill. And he had that knowledge, which he acquired in England as a boy. And there was an embargo against people with that knowledge leaving the country. He left in disguise. And Mr. Lowell of the Lowell Mass fame went over to England and stole property. And Alexander Hamilton, I'm told, wrote a manifesto at the start of the United States urging Americans to go steal intellectual property, okay? So nations, all nations do it when they're young. They eventually realize that this is a problem and that they should protect IP. Here's some interesting news, which I picked up on the weekend. There are now more suits for copyright infringement and intellectual property violation of rights in China on the part of where you have Chinese company going against Chinese company. And Huawei Electronics, which is the largest electronics company in China, second largest in the world, sued ZTE Electronics in Europe. So the message is coming across that intellectual property rights need to be protected. President Hu Jintao at the APEC conference actually committed to doing this, but as they say in China, the emperor's far away and the mountains are high and the emperor's far away. So, you know, there's a lot of autonomy and that needs to be fixed over time. The internet governance issue is nettlesome. The U.S. and other nations do need to understand the strengths and weaknesses of the multi-stakeholder model that's in use today. Because cyberspace is global, the interest of all nations must be considered. Jim Lewis, who was at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, in a recent article on stewardship in cyberspace, published in March by the Monk School at the University of Toronto, presents such an analysis. This subject is going to require years of research analysis. Now, there is a major contention between the U.S. and Russia, China, Kazakhstan, and a few other nations, and even to some extent the Europeans, over this question of multi-stakeholder model. The U.S. government backs it 100%. There was a House hearing on this a couple of weeks ago there was bipartisan support for this, but that means there is not an opportunity for enforcement on the part of countries when things go awry. And, you know, Jim Lewis makes an interesting, does an interesting piece of analysis there. So if conflict between nations were to occur in cyberspace, I worry that we may destroy our economies, which is not a desirable outcome. Thus, nations must put their heads together to avoid such a possibility. This is going to require understandings between bilateral, multilateral understandings, hotlines. There is a hotline now in between Russia and the U.S. It lands for cyber issues, and it lands in the same watch and warning area of the State Department as the nuclear hotline. We're going to need norms, codes of conduct, possibly treaties, and the best analytical minds must take up this challenge, particularly the legal community. Thank you.
All right. I'm Maxim Weinstein. I'm the executive director of Stop Badware, which is an anti-malware nonprofit organization based in Cambridge and originally spun off from the Berkman Center. It was a project there started by John Palfrey and Jonathan Zittrain several years ago. And we spun off about 2.5 years ago. Most cybercrime, in fact, the vast majority of cybercrime that gets news attention is data breaches, like Kyle talked about, and cyber espionage, like John talked about. And for good reason. These are very important, and also they make great news stories because they tend to be, you get these very big sensationalized incidents like 6.5 million passwords being stolen at one time. However, most of the actual cybercrime that takes place on a day-to-day basis that affects individual users in their day-to-day lives is the sort of mass market cybercrime that comes from things like malware, malicious advertisements, counterfeit goods, deceptive online fraud, basically. And so in the malware space in particular, what you've probably heard a lot about in the last year or two is Stuxnet and Flame. And probably the one exception to this rule is the flashback malware on the Mac, because it was a new thing. But for the most part, we've heard a lot about the cyber espionage malware, Stuxnet and Flame. But I'm going to talk about the cyber crime side of the world. And specifically, I'm going to talk about two types of malware that are very closely linked to each other, botnets and what we call web-based malware, which is actually the focus of Stop Badware's work. So just a little brief background here. Botnets are networks of computers that have been infected by malware. So in other words, I get malware on my computer is now infected. 1,000, 10,000 other people also have malware on their computer, they've gotten infected with the same type of malware, and there is some person or group somewhere that is centrally controlling that entire network of infected computers. They can remotely determine what those computers can do. What can they do? They can send spam. They can cause denial of service attacks against specific targets. They can spread more malware. They can be used to host phishing sites for various phishing schemes. The other thing that's interesting about the malware that makes up these botnets is that, first of all, it's often silent on the computer that's there. So there may be no visible symptoms for someone whose computer is infected, because the whole idea of the botnet is to stay under the radar and do its work. It's also often bundled with other malware. So if you have a bot on your computer, there's a pretty good chance you also have something that's going to steal your passwords, try to log into your online banking account, and so on. Now, so that's botnets. Then we have web-based malware. So the question, of course, is how do people get this malware on their computers in the first place? And the answer a lot of the time is web-based malware. That's when a website is being used to distribute malware to people who visit the site. Comes in a few different forms. It can be what we call a drive-by download. Drive-by download means you visit a website, your computer gets infected. Okay. You didn't do anything, you didn't click any buttons, download anything, you just visited the site and the software downloads silently to your computer. This usually happens because maybe you're surfing along, you visit a website, you have a 6 month out of date version of Java or Flash Player on your computer, you know, you've been getting those little update warnings but you haven't updated, that kind of thing. And there's code on that website that is actually designed to attack that little vulnerability and silently install the software. We also have fake antivirus sites. Some of you may have encountered these. You visit a site and suddenly you get this fairly realistic looking warning that says, you have viruses on your computer. You know, you have 327 detected pieces of malware. Click here to remove this, and when you click there, it downloads some actual malware to your computer. Also, other types of social engineering. You get you need to install the latest version of Flash Player to watch this video of insert popular new artist here, or insert attractive woman, you know, with, you know, promises of getting to see her nude, you know, that kind of thing. So these websites, these sort of websites that are distributing malware kind of come in three flavors. There's the ones that are just set up for no other purpose than to engage in this criminal activity. We consider those the malicious websites or malicious URLs. They've been set up for this purpose by criminals. And there's all kinds of techniques for doing these and slipping under the radar to do it. Then there's what we call the compromised websites. These are the ones where someone has actually hacked in, usually through an automated process, not manually, but someone has hacked into a website and inserted malicious code onto that website without the owner's knowledge. And so then you have, you know, your best friend's blog that you read every day, and suddenly your best friend's blog has malware on it and is distributing malware, and your friend probably doesn't know about it. And then the third possibility is what we call malvertising, malicious advertising. And what happens there is someone sneaks an ad into the online advertising stream that either links to or uses code to directly deliver malware. And so then when you're a customer of an ad network as a website owner and you just have, you know, banner ads that rotate through from the ad network each time someone visits a site, one of those ads that pops up happens to have malware or malicious code. So lots of different tricks for getting these things in front of users. Now, from a sort of legal and policy implication standpoint, to me there's three really big issues that we deal with as we're trying to address issues of both botnets and web-based malware. The first is this really somewhat unusual case where the victim is also an unwitting accomplice in the crime. So if I have a computer and I've gotten a virus on my computer, I'm a victim, right? I may be getting my information stolen, my computer is being used without my permission, right? But I'm also now an accomplice. My computer is now essentially perpetuating crime without me even knowing about it. That's an interesting case, and it creates some very difficult challenges. If you imagine a scenario, this is a fairly real-world scenario here. Some criminal group puts out a script and it goes around looking for versions of WordPress that are out of date, finds a bunch of them, infects 10,000 websites over the course of 24 hours. So now you have 10,000 websites out there, they're all infected. Each of the owners of those sites, people like you and me who just have a blog, have a, you know, have a small business website running on WordPress, that kind of thing, are now both victims and putting everyone who comes to their website at risk. Let's go super conservative and say 10 people get infected from each one of these websites. Suddenly we now have 100,000 people with malware on their computers because of this one overnight attack. And the challenge is, what do you do about this? especially for law enforcement, right? What does law enforcement do when 10,000 people who don't know they're committing crimes or are perpetuating crime are perpetuating crime? How do you deal with that? Are you going to go subpoena 10,000 people who are located all over the world and, you know, who haven't actually done all that much wrong other than maybe failing to update their computer? Probably not. But what do you do? So that's one of the big challenges that we face in this area. The second is one of identification. And in the case of identification, really two areas. One is connecting domain names with real people. And the other is connecting IP addresses with real people. Domain names, usually in the case of websites. IP addresses, usually in the case of, sometimes in the case of websites also, but especially in the case of infected computers, computers that have bots on them. And again, you have a lot of challenges here. ICANN has a policy that requires accredited domain name registrars to have what are called whois records, which is basically some indication of contact information for the person who registered the domain name. Both the policy and the enforcement of the policy are quite broken. And the result of that, and there's also other issues that go on, including something called privacy proxies that people use. And look, there's good reasons why people may want to have privacy and not have their name and contact information out there associated with a domain. You know, it's less obvious perhaps in the US, but certainly in countries with oppressive governments, you can certainly imagine why people would want that kind of privacy. Even here, there are reasons people just don't want to be spammed. They don't want to be connected to something political that they're doing on their website or whatever. And so it becomes very difficult to actually get in touch with, or even for, at times for law enforcement, to track down the right person, especially if the domain name is registered in another country, the website is hosted, the IP address is hosted in another country. It becomes very difficult. And then the third issue that we have is one of liability. And I'll give you another example here. Suppose we have that same 10,000 websites that have been compromised, and we know that 1,000 of them sitting at some web hosting provider got compromised because the hosting provider didn't do a good job of securing its servers. It didn't install the latest patches for its customers. Furthermore, once the 1,000 sites got infected, Stop Badware, Symantec, McAfee, some reputable security organization contacts that web hosting provider and says, hey, look, we have firm evidence that 1,000 of your customers' websites have malware on them. Here's the evidence. Here's the websites. Do something about this. You know, and why are we contacting the hosting provider? First of all, because we see a concentration of them there. And second, because we have a really hard time identifying the actual people behind all these websites, but identifying the hosting provider is fairly easy. And then what happens? Well, the web hosting provider has no legal obligation whatsoever, and in fact is shielded from liability for doing anything, right? The Communications Decency Act, Section 230, has some pretty broad protections for hosting providers that are hosting user-generated or user-created content for good reasons. There's good reasons we don't want providers being liable for any old bad content that any user posts. But we have this sort of extreme edge case here where you potentially have a provider who knows there's a problem, knows people are actually being put at risk on an ongoing basis, and can choose to do nothing and have absolutely zero liability and no obligation to do anything about it. There was one exception to this that I can talk about, and that was in 2009, the Federal Trade Commission managed to shut down a hosting provider called 3FN. 3FN was, they were way beyond what you might otherwise consider sort of negligent or sort of sleeping on the security job. These guys were actively malicious. They were targeting advertising at the underground criminal communities, saying, "Hey, here's a place to host your websites." They were, they were going out of their way to help their customers avoid takedown and avoid detection. And the FTC managed to get them taken down. But that's a pretty extreme case. Much more common is companies saying, look, this is the customer's problem. It's not our problem. It costs us too much money to do support, or to address these issues. So we're just going to push all the responsibility off to the customer and take no responsibility ourselves. And legally, they can do that. So those are three challenges and things that I think are sort of interesting and ongoing challenges for us.
If I speak here, can you hear me? All right. My name is Peter Eckersley. I'm Technology Projects Director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. As many of you will know, we're a nonprofit, a 501c3 based in San Francisco, that works on a wide range of internet policy issues, including privacy, freedom of speech and censorship, computer security, copyright policy, innovation, etc. I'm a computer scientist by background, but I also work on, so I spend a fraction of my time doing policy stuff, coming here, talking to policy audiences, being involved in helping our lawyers with court cases, and a fraction of my time writing code and actually trying to make the internet more secure. We have a range of projects like that. One is HTTPS Everywhere, which is a browser extension for Firefox and Chrome that if you don't already have installed, you should all go and install it. It encrypts your communications with a large range of websites. We also work on projects related to the authentication mechanisms that the web uses, including the SSL observatory and sovereign keys. And so I have a few different perspectives to bring to these discussions about computer security and internet security. But I want to start by asking the question, which is, why do we need computer security? You know, what objective are we trying to obtain by making our systems more secure? And the objectives seem to fall into a number of different buckets, at least three buckets, three large ones. The first is preserving the privacy of our documents and our communications. Whether we're individuals or corporations or other forms of organizations, we need to have the right to keep our own thoughts and documents private or to only share them with the parties we intend to share them with. And I think it's obvious why that's valuable to a lot of people. A second large category is correctness of financial transactions. If I intend to send $100 to Alice, but not to send $1,000 to Bob, then the internet and my computer, I hope, aren't going to let Bob take the $1,000 from me without my permission. The third category is to ensure the integrity of other functions that we ask our computers to perform for us. And this is maybe less common for a lot of us, but a lot of this computer security stuff that you read about in the news, Stuxnet, we're talking about whether a set of centrifuges that the Iranians had were going to correctly be centrifuges. And you can equally raise the same kinds of questions about whether a computer you have attached to a power station is going to send the right control signals to the power station. So these are three large buckets of purposes that we should keep in mind during this conversation. Now, are computers getting more secure? This is a big, interesting question. Certainly, our technology is getting better in a whole lot of other ways. It's getting faster, it has more memory, it has better wireless and wired communications protocols, it does niftier stuff for us more conveniently. Surely it's also getting more secure, right? That's another feature in the long list of features, and as we have more memory, we have more security, right? The counterintuitive property of computer security, at least certainly to policymakers and sometimes to us as programmers as well, is that this isn't necessarily true. The number of bugs in a computer program is proportional to the size and complexity of the computer program. So as our computers get fancier, they have more places where they can make mistakes. And once a computer program is making a mistake somewhere, that's an opportunity for some other party to sneak in and send an unexpected piece of data to the program that gets control of it or makes it do something it wasn't supposed to do. So in that sense, we might expect our computers to be getting less and less secure as they become more and more featureful. This story isn't exactly true either. The underlying truth is gray and murky because on our side, on the side of security, there's also the fact that we've learned a lot about how to make computers more secure, how to write better code. We've learned, maybe not all programmers have learned these things, but there's a specialized subfield of security auditors who know how to go in and look at a code base and search for the kinds of mistakes that get made that make programs insecure. We're writing our software with higher level languages that can have more structural protections against bugs built into the language. And we have more of a kind of craft knowledge about how to use these tools well. So these things have to be traded off. Perhaps our systems are getting more secure a little bit slowly, but if it's happening at all, it's only happening slowly. So we know there are some important reasons to want security, and we know that it isn't at all certain that we're gonna get it automatically just by standing back and watching computers and the internet evolve. And there are lots of things we can do about this. As computer scientists, there are many things you can do in your work to make systems more secure, but because we're talking about cyber law and policy today, I'm gonna just talk about what we can do, what governments and policymakers might be able to do to help our computers and our networks be more secure. And you know, one set of mechanisms, Max was talking about these, is trying to help people clean up after systems that have been compromised. And that's important, but I think it's also necessary to recognize that if you're cleaning up after systems that are already compromised, you know, you've already lost. This should be a policy of last resort. The higher priority is probably to make our platforms more inherently secure, so you have less of this problem of chasing around IP addresses that seem to be hosting malware and trying to figure out how to get the malware off those machines. We need to make our computers so robust that they don't care if their web browser is being pointed at a malicious domain. It's also perhaps helpful to work towards the goal of having computers where exploits and compromise are inherently transitory. Or transient. So once a user may click on the wrong thing and install the wrong thing on one day, but they won't need to go and reinstall to clean up. The operating system and the computer itself will somehow reinstall for them once someone notices that this attack is in the wild. Now, there's a huge proviso that I want to add to that desirable goal, which is we've seen companies beginning to build these systems. Google's doing it, Apple's doing it, Microsoft is doing it. But sometimes, when they do it, they also do it in a way that locks out the opportunity for third parties or users to modify their operating systems. And from our point of view, as an advocate of users, this is actually an unacceptable violation of people's right to tinker with their computers and to do new cool things with them, and even to audit the security of their own systems. So Microsoft with their ARM version of Windows and Apple with all of its iOS devices are going firmly into this problematic territory of saying security is a pretense for us to say thou shalt not be able to install Linux on this device ever. Or if you're going to install Linux on it, it'll only be one official version of Linux that we've blessed, and if you want to recompile your kernel to add extra security features or to audit something to see if we're sending data back to the mothership that you didn't want us to be, sorry, you're out of luck. So there needs to always be a user control mechanism that can be tied into these platform level security features. And that's maybe a question for policymakers to look at. What kind of rules should be applied in the marketplace if companies like Microsoft or Apple are gonna go out and build this stuff and then lock out user modification or competitors through security means? Now, there are other things that policymakers should be thinking about. One is that I don't know how many people here are familiar with the economic concept of a public good or a public bad. Raise a hand if you know what these things are. So about half of you. Public goods are a piece of economic jargon for situations in which I do something that benefits a lot of other people. A concrete example in computer security terms, if I write SSH, a very nifty little security program, and I publish it for the world on my website, that's a public good that I've produced. If I write a web application framework and give it to the world, that's a public good. But if there's a bug that I failed to check for in that web application framework, that's a public bad. Everyone who gets a copy of my framework is now exposed to this risk, and perhaps you'll experience some significant harm. And this can happen whether or not I'm an open source developer or I'm a proprietary commercial software vendor who sells a copy of a web application framework that has a bug in it. And we know from economics that the incentives for producing public goods or avoiding producing public bads are frequently wrong. Like, the marketplace just doesn't allocate the right amount of money as a payoff for working on these kinds of problems. And I think this is a potential policy problem. One thing that gets talked about a lot, as a way of addressing it, is there should be some kind of liability regime for software vendors, people who make software, such that they have to pay when there are bugs that cause insecurity in their software. And I'm not super convinced that that's the best policy avenue to go down for dealing with this problem. For one reason, it actually undermines the incentives that people have to do open source public goods security work in the first place. If I make a free version of SSH that makes the world way better, and then you're telling me, well, I'm liable for a bug that was in that code that I produced, I might be less inclined to produce this public good in the first place. And so if we are going to go down the road of liability regimes, we'd have to figure out how to not create disincentives for free and open source software development. But perhaps there are other kinds of mechanisms that could be explored for getting the same result. Perhaps policymakers or governments could actually just directly or indirectly fund incentives for people to find and report vulnerabilities. And that's a nice model, because often the people with the best skills for finding these things are not the same people who wrote the code in the first place. And so we see this a little bit in the private sector, with companies introducing bug bounties and saying, hey, if you find a bug in our code, we'll pay you to tell us about it. Perhaps there's more that can be done to encourage and support this model, which inherently ensures that more of the bugs are fixed before they fall into the hands of the bad guys than the other way around. So, I think another avenue that policymakers should explore more deeply is funding R&D for better security protocols, tools, and platforms. And we already see that the US federal government, in a sense, doing quite a good job of this, up to a point. There's a lot of academic funding for computer security that's built great stuff that we use all the time. And we see initiatives like the NIST Trusted Identities in Cyberspace program, which may end up turning into the same kind of thing. But perhaps there are ways to fine-tune those programs, especially on the academic side. I think a lot of academic researchers say, oh, you know, I work on a project until I get my paper out of it, and then the source code is somewhere up on the web, but they're going to move their attention onto working on something else. So there's a bit of an institutional design problem there. How do you get incentives for academics who have the skills and the knowledge to improve the security of the internet to keep working on that? Or, you know, maybe academia is not the right place to do it, but what kind of institutional pipeline could policymakers foster that would get better results here? Now, lastly, I want to talk about some bad ideas for fixing cybersecurity through policy. And we saw a number of these displayed concretely in the CISPA bill and versions of the CISPA bill before it was passed by the House. Some of these were removed as it was being amended. Some of them certainly weren't. We don't want a solution to the internet or network security problem that undermines one of the major objectives, the major reasons why we want security in the first place, and that is the confidentiality of people's documents, communications, and identities. And some of these bills that were proposed outright create giant data pipelines flowing to security agencies within the federal government and backwards and forwards into the private sector without the kinds of protections that people need to know that if they send an email to someone else or a communication or a document, that there isn't a huge amount of this data being basically recorded by the network and databased in a bunch of places. And there were basically no protections for the kinds of civil liberties you expect. Law enforcement needs probable cause and a warrant before they come and read your documents, et cetera. So that would be one catastrophic way to fail at doing better security through policy. Another thing that I think is very alarming is proposals for linking or confusing computer security with copyright enforcement. Now, it's an empirical fact that 20 to 40% of the US population engages in copyright infringement on a regular basis. And so in a sense, you don't need a huge data set observing people's network behavior to realize that this is true. You just go into a survey and ask people, and once you get their guard down a little bit, you get these enormous percentages of people. And the problem there is that we have copyright laws that are not actually compatible with current human social norms and behavior. And if you have that situation where you have a statute on the books and a set of behavior that's wildly inconsistent with the statute, you have different responses that you can try to make. But I'd argue the wrong one is to say, well, let's surveil everyone to try and radically change their behavior to make them comply with this statute. Probably what you should start by doing is going back and saying, how can we alter our copyright laws, redesign them so that they achieve the legitimate policy objectives that those statutes have without being wildly inconsistent with people's behavior. And I think people within the copyright industries are starting to understand that. You're starting to see more exploration of business models that don't have this problem. You know, Spotify in the case of music, we almost got there a little bit with Google Books as a policy solution. It didn't quite happen. But over the next 10 years, 5 to 10 years, I think there'll be a lot more discussions about how we structurally fix copyright so it doesn't matter what people are doing with their internet connections. And that's much better as a policy process than saying, okay, let's surveil everyone to find the 40% of them who are copying things. So I think those are the opening comments that I have.
Thank you. I appreciate everybody's comments. I actually wanted to follow up with the rest of the panel, what Peter's saying. Peter is suggesting there's a market failure of some sort. And there's actually been some research. Tyler Moore has shown that phishing sites last, the amount of time phishing sites last really depends on what they're phishing for. Bank sites go down very quickly because the banks really look out for them. Online pharmaceutical sites seem to last forever. Child pornography sites take a long time to come down. Malware is another example of potential market failure. The fact that my dad's computer takes 20 minutes to boot, and every time you hit a key, you can go out for a cup of coffee and come back, doesn't seem to bother him the slightest, even though there's free anti-malware out there. So I guess my question for the rest of the panel would be, is there a market failure? And actually, Kyle talked about, you know, the current liability regime really doesn't put much pressure on companies to protect information. There may be some other pressures there. So my question would be, is there a market failure? And if there is, what can we do about it? Or perhaps which of Peter's suggestions do you like?
I can talk to one specific market failure that has been partially addressed in an interesting free market solution, which is the issue that if you have a website and you suddenly have malware that's infected your website, there are a number of reasons that you might not be in that big a hurry to clean it up, or to tell anybody, or to really take any sort of action at all. One, people may not know your site has malware because malware tends to be pretty quiet about doing its dirty business. You certainly may not want to post something on your website because you don't want to announce to your customers, say if you're a small business, that hey, our systems got hacked, and it's the same issue with data breaches. And one of the partial solutions to this was something that Google started doing about 6 years ago, and that Stop Adware has been involved in since the beginning, which was Google said, if we detect malware on a website, we're going to put up a big warning. When somebody searches Google and finds a website and goes to click on the result, instead of taking them to the web page, we're going to take them to what they call an interstitial page, which says, warning, this site may harm your computer. Those warnings have since been extended to be included in the Chrome browser, in the Firefox web browser, Safari. IE has kind of its own equivalent of this using its own data, whereas all the others use Google's data. And this suddenly dramatically changes the incentives for a site owner, especially for an owner of a business website. Because if people are trying to find your site or navigate to your site and they're getting a big warning message that they shouldn't go there, that's going to hurt your traffic. If you're a business, hurting your traffic means hurting your bottom line. And suddenly companies want to find out, what do I need to do to get this warning taken off? At which point they frequently send nasty messages to either Google or to Stop Badware, saying, how dare you say these awful things about our website, you Nazis, or you know, various other colorful epithets. But it works. What we find is, especially for for-profit companies, this has a huge economic incentive in terms of creating action, because the only way you're going to get that warning taken down is to convince Google that your website doesn't have malware on it anymore. And the way you're going to do that is you're going to clean up your website.
Does it actually stop the spread, though? How many people click through those, even though there's a warning? Yeah, there's got to be some. There's probably more. I mean, I think the spread is not stopped by that. The company acts on behalf of its own best interests in that regard. So as a business decision, absolutely. But yeah. I know that some of the databases that we have at Harvard that are by companies, we get the warning certificate when we use these. And these are behind a pin wall and protected, and we still get the warning. And the students are like, well, either I access this or I don't. And I need to access it to do the work, so I just click. They're ignoring it.
That happens. I mean, that said, we you know, it slows the spread. It doesn't stop the spread. But I mean, I can tell you from the business site owners who contact us that, you know, we don't have hard data, but what we do have is the anecdotal data of people saying, help, my site traffic dropped off 70% because of this warning. And if that means 70% of the potential people at risk suddenly aren't at risk anymore, I'd consider that a success, even if not a complete one.
There are other examples I heard of the market responding. I heard of one over the weekend where someone from Hewlett-Packard said that they were warned by the United States government that their BIOS, there's a BIOS and printer and all kinds of equipment, not just computers, that they were susceptible to breach, to violation. And the industry, at great expense, came forward with an idea to make it more secure by having there be a core BIOS, which was in the processor, and then all these peripheral units you had to have the firmware signed before it could be installed. So it was a way of controlling the whole process. And this was cited as an example where the changes that were made were not due to regulation law, but they were in response to reputational issues, shame. I think myself that shame is a very powerful factor, reputation is a very powerful factor, and it ought to be used more often.
I had one more question, then I was going to open it to the audience. Last week, the New York Times had a pretty impressive article showing that Stuxnet was a result of the U.S. and Israel. And today there's a bunch of articles, one in Computer World, that linked Flame to the same writers of Stuxnet, mm-hmm. showing that the same source code is in both. Mark Ambender at Atlantic asked the question, did America's cyber attack on Iran make us more vulnerable? And it's an interesting question. We're obviously one of the countries that's most reliant on computers. There's a lot of companies that probably could get away with computers not being accessible. I know that when my internet went down, it was such a crisis, I went out and got a dual band router and a second internet connection, and that was just for an hour or two. So the question is, where was it a bright thing for America to be sort of the forefront of cyber attacks, and where does it put us in terms of cybersecurity?
Well, one can interpret what happened as a public or overt act. It was not intended that way, of course. It was meant to be covert. And there is the debate is that on the one side, on the one hand, this bought the West time to try to pursue diplomatic initiatives. It was never meant to be disclosed. And that was a positive aspect of this. As the various commentators have pointed out, the fact that the United States and Israel are both now associated with Stuxnet, which is clearly an offensive weapon, now raises the question, how serious an attack was it? Their commentators have said, well, it wasn't, it knocked out under 1,800, I think it was 892 centrifuges, and it slowed down the refinement process a little while, but in fact it may have actually accelerated it, because now recognizing they were in a deficit, that they enhanced their activity. The jury is still out there. If people who look at this and say, well, it might not have been designed primarily to be to just destroy as many centrifuges as they could, it might have been a signal that of the intent of the West or whoever was opposed to this refinement process, a signal that they were prepared to do more. Now that it's been revealed, I think they've lost that option. But it's certainly it's a complicating issue, and it changes the balance at a time when the West is competing with Russia, China, and other nations who belong to the Shanghai Cooperative SCO, who are trying to influence the developing countries, each of whom has one vote at the UN, at the ITU, to have the ITU play a much bigger role in internet governance. And if that happens, I think that will be very unfortunate. So it could blow back on us in that respect and create serious difficulty.
From a pure malware standpoint, I mean, there's no question that it increased our risk in the sense that there's now code floating around out there that criminals can copy and adapt and make use of to create new types of malware for other purposes other than what this was intended for. I think, as John said, this in a case like this, this isn't something where it's an isolated thing and you can just look at the technology piece. There's much broader political and national defense questions than did this make us at slightly higher risk of malware. Yes, it did. There's also all kinds of new strategies and attacks coming out for malware being developed by the criminals all the time. So having one additional, even fairly sophisticated type of malware, I'm not sure changes things that much. It incrementally increases our risk. The other thing about Stuxnet that I think was very interesting is that Stuxnet, from what I understand, was intended to only infect the computers at the nuclear power plant. It didn't. It also infected thousands and thousands of other computers, including of individual civilians and citizens in and outside of Iran. This is probably one of the earlier cases we've seen of direct collateral damage.
The Morris worm, I think, was the first.
That is the number one. I was just
right.
That.
But the Morris worm wasn't a state actor, and that's what I mean in the sense that here is a state actor using malware for a state purpose and having collateral damage against potentially citizens of its own country, and I think that's important. Was it major damage? No, because this was malware whose primary purpose was to mess up centrifuges, and people aren't using centrifuges at home. But it might not count as damage under the under the laws that that Kyle was talking about before. But it's collateral damage in the sense that if you have a computer and suddenly you have something behaving badly, you're getting an antivirus warning saying something's doing something it's not supposed to do, and you have to take the time and money to hire a computer consultant to fix your computer and so on, that's damage to you. It's economic damage to an individual. So I do think that's an important thing that we need to keep a close eye on as cyber espionage and at the government level continues to develop.
Let me just quickly say that Stuxnet is a worm, meaning that it's designed to, independently of any other application, propagate itself. But it was designed, as Max said, only to activate a fire on a particular machine which had a particular piece of software running at a Siemens 7. It had to have connected to that computer a set of programmable logic controllers that were manufactured by Siemens, and it had to have the right number. So the conditions apparently were only met for it to activate, and start trying to destroy centrifuges at the Natanz plant. Okay, so the collateral damage really was absolutely minor, in my view. It was just the program copied itself onto machines outside of the facility in Natanz.
But under, so we're talking about civil law, then we talked about locking people up for malware, and then we're talking about, you know, international law and acts of warfare. I mean, so where does this jump into? Goes all the entire spectrum. So, I mean, normally you have to get a UN Security Council or have to authorize a Caroline Standard preemptive strike. So, as Caroline Standard is when Canadian troops, I believe, came over the border into US and burned a ship up, supporting England. They basically burned our ship and sent it over the Niagara Falls as a preemptive strike to prevent weapons from going into the country and fighting England. And that standard has been applied to the international cyber warfare arena from time to time. And the idea behind that is, was this a preemptive strike? Was it authorized? Is it under the UN Charter, Article 52A, in which we don't need the UN Security Council because we're pursuing over the border? It's a whole, I mean, we could probably have a whole panel on that. But it makes me nervous, actually, that we struck that and that much collateral damage, because I'm assuming the people who designed this had exactly what you said in mind. They're like, just affecting these computers that control these things, and nevertheless, it's still spread, like the Morris worm.
But the Morris worm actually shut down a large portion of the internet.
This
did not shut down anything or do any damage outside of that particular facility.
But I think, as Peter points out, the more lines of code you have, the more chance there are of it not doing what you expect.
For the most part, I want to avoid commenting about Stuxnet and the military use of computer security tools. Fundamentally, I doubt that any of the decision makers are going to listen to anything that I have to say about the subject. But one thing that we do know fairly reliably is that unless you can test a piece of code in the environment in which it's going to be used, the only thing you can predict is that you won't be able to predict what it'll do exactly. And probably what you see there is just an example of that.
Sure.
I wanted to invite questions from the audience if there are. We have about 50 minutes.
John Griffin from Telecommunication Systems. Very interesting panelists, by the way. Thank you. This was an outstanding set of people. I've been to some DC area security conferences, if you will, where one of the things that has been discussed is whether or not American citizens should be allowed to retaliate if they are personally victims of a cyber attack from inside or outside the country. I'm curious as to whether the panel has any thoughts on that, ranging from possible Second Amendment type concerns of cyber weapons to, you know, just how you feel about that in general in light of the discussion on Stuxnet.
You're referring to hack, but what people call hackback. Somebody's hack attacking you, so you want to go after their computers. The Computer Crime and Abuse Act makes that illegal, is my understanding. I'm not a lawyer, although I did sleep in a Motel 6 last night. I don't see any reason why you couldn't leave a file on your computer which has a name that would be very attractive to a hacker. And if that hacker brings it home, I don't know how to do this, by the way, brings it home and reads it, or, you know, with his or her analysis tool, causes that machine to self-destruct or something. If we did have the authorization to do that, would we fall into the category of a patriotic hacker? There is an analogy people have made between patriotic hackers and privateers. You know, privateers were these ships that were given, ship owners were given letters of marque. And by the way, our U.S. Constitution does authorize Congress to issue letters of marque, and the piracy court, the Supreme Court is, I think, what they call a piracy court, one to adjudicate these issues dealing with letters of marque. We had, the U.S. at the time of the Revolutionary War had, I think, five times as many ships who were privateers in our service as we had actual ships in the Navy. And so this business of having privateers was something that was very common. There were lots of them out there, and for several centuries, I think 2.5 centuries or something like that, privateers were very commonly used by governments. It gave them plausible deniability until things got out of hand, and then they had to collectively decide to shut it all down. So if we gave the right, let's say, to American companies in the defense and industrial base to fire back at those who are trying to penetrate their computers, there are some very interesting issues that would develop, I think, as a result of that. Not that it's necessarily wrong, but it is fraught with all kinds of concerns.
Well, I'm going to go the other way, because I am a lawyer, so ready? So there's something in the law called self-help, which is very similar to strike back. So somebody steals my bicycle and puts it on their property. I have the right to trespass onto their property to get my bicycle back. Additionally, there are satellite companies that face no liability when they use electronic countermeasures to stop the pirating of their signals. They're allowed to do that. Additionally, banks face no liability when they trespass on someone's property to repossess items that the people have no longer paid for. These analogies have existed in the law for a long time, and they're being played out with the idea of strike backs. There was actually a bill introduced into Congress a few sessions ago, which had that copyright component, which you were talking about earlier, where copyright law and information basically said it was trying to allow the copyright companies to go in and destroy files that they found on people's servers that were owned by them. Copyrights, self-help. So this concept does exist. I'm sorry, you had something else.
Well, I think it's a terrible mistake to reason about computer attacks against computers on networks using the tempting metaphor of bullets or arrows that like come flying at you and you can fire back. You know, when you receive a packet with an exploit payload in it over the network, there's a significant chance that it's coming from a computer that isn't owned in the legal sense by the person who's attacking you. It's the common case that you're receiving this packet from a compromised system, and supposing in the extreme case that you happen to have a zero-day exploit lying around and a way of deploying it against that machine, and then you send something back and zero the file system, delete all the files on the machine that attacked you, the chances are you just made the harm to an innocent third party much worse. And so that isn't to say that legally speaking there might not be a good justification under some circumstances for an affected party to take their own take the matter into their own hands, or that under some circumstances there might not be effective ways of doing that. Having a file lying around on your computer that looks tempting, and if someone opens it in the wrong way, it phones back to you saying, hey, by the way, the person who attacked you is, their real laptop is at this IP address, you know, you could send that to law enforcement. There may be ways to do effective self-help, just it isn't as simple and naive as firing back at the machine that you saw coming in.
Right, I think, you know, self-help is different from retaliation, right? Trespassing on someone's property to retrieve your own property is quite different than, you know, stealing something of theirs because they stole something of yours, right? And I think that's an important distinction. I also think about the various challenges with stand your ground laws that we've been hearing about a lot in the news right now. And again, I think it comes back to, you know, just like Peter said about not using that bullet metaphor, I'd also say, you know, again, like I said earlier, there's a difference between cyber espionage, cyber warfare, and cyber crime. And what we're talking about here, for the most part, with individuals being attacked means they're having something stolen from them, or their computers are being used to steal something. It's a form of theft. It's not a form of physical assault. It's not a form of warfare. It's a form of crime. And I do think we want to make sure that any laws or legal frameworks we're creating differentiate between these different types of situation.
You had a question?
Yes. I, My name is Zhu Yixu from Chinese Academy of Sciences. Thank you, first of all, for inspirational opening and talks. I have a question to all of the experts in the panel. Are there any fundamental principles of cyber law? Let's say, just limit those principles to five or three that are free from politics or from short-term commercial interests that will hold, you know, today, 50 years from today. So, for instance, should we just borrow or transfer the laws from the physical world or the human society world to the cyber world? Would that be enough? Or are there any distinct features of the cyberspace that we should consider? Let me give you two specific examples. One is that should the cyberspace have borders? Okay, and also, should the site owners have any obligations at all? Some of you touched this a little bit, but can we have some scientific principles to judge this? For instance, about the privacy, you know, we at the U.S. borders, we connect fingerprints. People do not maybe, you know, think that's a violation of people's privacy that much because we need homeland security, right? So that's my question. Are there any, you know, scientific fundamental principles? Thank you.
Here's one. Our laws, whether they're for computers or anything else, should serve the interests of the people who use those computers.
Yes.
That's a fundamental principle. I predict it'll be still useful in 50 years' time.
Right. I'll tell you what I think ought to be done. Observe that most of the, first there is this economic principle that you often should deal with intermediaries rather than end users because the end users don't have the means to respond. I have an infected computer. If the government wants to find all the infected computers, it's going to be an enormously complicated task. If instead there is an intermediary you can turn to who can deal with the issue, has the means to deal with the issue, has the tools, then you should use the intermediary. It's more effective. I want to illustrate what I think can be done today that is not political, and it is this, that if you look at the structure of the internet, it consists of a number of very large internet service providers who, and there is a small number of these, for example, in the case of the United States, who service more than 90% of all of the end users in the United States. Now, I wrote a paper with Melissa Hathaway on stewardship in cyberspace, duties for internet service providers, and we listed 8 duties for internet service providers, and I'm just going to read a couple of them to you. I'm going to preface this by saying that when an internet service provider joins the internet, why do they do that? Well, they have customers, and they want to make available they want to provide to their customers access to the resources that are available on the rest of the internet. And in turn, they want to make available the resources that their customers are going to provide to the users on the internet. So when an internet service provider joins the internet, or a country joins the internet, why does it do that? Because there's mutual benefit, okay? So it seems to me that when that joining occurs, there are certain duties that each of the countries or internet service providers obtain. They have these duties that they acquire. They are often unwritten. And so the question is, can you write them down? And I'm going to read a few of them to you that are in our paper. Duty to provide a reliable and accessible conduit for traffic and services. In other words, you say, I'm going to announce that there's a path to the Chinese Institute for International Studies, or whatever it's called, I've forgotten the name. Okay, well, if you announce that, and if I send a packet to that institution, it should get there, and if it's not going to get there, it seems to me you have an obligation to tell the sender, we're not delivering that packet, okay? Second one, duty to provide authentic and authoritative routing information. There is this concept of IP hijacking, and we don't want IP addresses to be hijacked by somebody else. And the third one is authentic and authoritative naming services. And then the fourth one could be help in trying to reduce the number of botnets by informing your customers, the ISP's customers, that their machines are thought to be infected. And if they're thought to be infected, then they give them tools to try to clean them up. And if they don't follow that advice, the ISP might even be willing to quarantine the computer. Comcast has been doing that. This is a major tier one ISP in the United States. So finding duties like that that are common to all countries, because why? Because they all want to participate in the internet. They want a good quality of service. They want to offer good quality service. This doesn't have to do with control of content. It doesn't have to do with freedom of speech or internet freedom. It just speaks to the question of the way the internet should function in order for everything to work properly.
I always quote, don't let the bow tie fool you. I listen to the Grateful Dead. John Perry Barlow wrote the Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace a while ago. It was kind of a libertarian view of this borderless one. I always kind of quote that, and I pulled up my favorite part here. So we are creating an internet world that all may enter without privilege or prejudice, according by race, economic power, military force, or station of birth. I'm always in the full agreement that, sure, I work as a lawyer and we like to create borders, but that the internet is borderless. I mean, I can subpoena people, sure, and make them come places. We have lots of jurisdictional claims, but to be honest, it's hard. It's nearly impossible that I can tell to create a full border in cyberspace, which cannot be leaked out by satellite transmissions, ISP spoofing, server bounce out. There's a lot of things you can do. And so I always stick to this. Also, the international treaties that deal with economic, social rights and justice have this thing about there's a right to the free flow of information, and there's nothing more speaks of that than the actual internet itself. So that's kind of the principles that I hold to specifically when I'm talking about this.
So that better practice in the United States, and are all the laws of the United States complying with that declaration?
Doubtful. not at all. I mean, they say great things. We have no elected government, nor are we likely to have one. So I address you with no greater authority than which liberty itself speaks. I declare us free of the tyrannies you impose on us. Yet we have a lot of internet task force and other, you know. So it flies directly in the face of that. It's just, I think it's an aspirational goal. Absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to have to close out our panel now, but I really wanted to thank our panelists and for giving us an interesting discussion.